Well, how do you like or enjoy working with or living with somebody who lives in denial? You know anybody like that? I know, granted, that's a rather presumptuous question. But if you work with that kind of a person, you really do know how serious the question is. I mean, it's not a light matter. There are people who live in denial in such a way that they just try to put a positive spin on everything. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, they come up with something positive about it. Some of you are uneasy that I'm even talking about that, because you're starting to think maybe I'm a little bit pessimistic and not thinking positively. I'm not. You know, even as a young man, I never trusted Norman Vincent Peale. Now, to you young people, that's ancient history, but to us older people, I mean, we knew all about him and his best-selling book, Power Positive Thinking. If I'm not mistaken, he's the one also who kind of spearheaded the publishing of the Guidepost magazine that I know some of you get it because it's so positive. I never trusted the guy. I'm sorry, you know. Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich, best-selling book, never believed it, not for a minute. Robert Schuller and his Hour of Power, wasn't that what it was called? Broadcast from the Crystal Cathedral, which was supposed to be a great example of the results of positive thinking. If you just think positively, you'd have a nice glass building instead of our dinky old church here. And we're not out of the woods yet. I think Joel Osteen has probably taken up the mantle from those guys who are now dead. I don't trust him either. It just seems to me like these preachers of positive thinking never ever read the news. Or if they did, what did they do with it? I mean, how can you put a spin on some of this stuff? Did they just kind of pretend that the stuff you're reading about, hearing about, really didn't happen? Does that sound incredibly negative to you? I mean, you're sitting there right now saying, Pastor, you have been reading Ecclesiastes too much. You know, you better back off. Well, I'll be honest with you. The last time I tried to preach through Ecclesiastes, this is where I quit. I was going into chapter 7, and I said, I can't take it anymore. You know, I need to get positive. Does it sound like it's just all negative news? Well, let's just try to put everything in perspective here for a minute, okay? Preacher Solomon, he's called Koheleth. That's the preacher. I'm sure it was Solomon. He sets out to discover what is the source of all the joy, all the satisfaction that we have in life. How do we find satisfaction in life? Now, in light of the fact that he was the richest man of his day, he was one of the wisest people who ever lived, if not the wisest, next to Jesus Christ. And we have to conclude that if anybody had all the resources to find out the answer to these kinds of questions, where is satisfaction? How do we get joy in life? You would think that Solomon would be the person who had that resource, that opportunity. But in his words, having looked at every imaginable resource possible and trying to come to the right conclusions in his word, he comes up with this Hebrew word to describe life, hebel, vanity, vexation. It's like chasing after the wind and grabbing a handful of wind. That's how satisfying it is. It's just empty. Life is futile. Over and over and over throughout this book, Solomon keeps giving us this principle. Life is a dirt sandwich. Every day, another bite. That was his conclusion after going through all of these experiments. Well, you know, most people, I believe, have never really read Ecclesiastes. And those who have, probably it's divided on those who believe it and those who just disagree with it. But I know this. Following the mindset of people like Peale and Schuller and Osteen could cause you to just kind of put this book down and say, forget it. Let's just pretend that life's not like that. Well, let's just pretend that life is really, really positive, which is to say, let's just be unrealistic. Well, actually, there are places in this book where Solomon gets pretty positive. We've read some of those, where he has told us to enjoy the good things of life. This is what God has given you, to eat the fruits of your labor. You know, that was one of his conclusions. We ought to be satisfied with all the blessings that the Lord gives us. That's a good conclusion. In fact, that really is the whole point of this book. Learn how to be satisfied with what God gives you. And really, that's the point of the sermon here this evening out of chapter 6. Because what we find very clearly throughout this whole writing is the distinction between trying to be satisfied with all the passing things of life and discovering instead dissatisfaction, or learning how to be satisfied with God and all that He gives you. And that's the distinction that's given to us here in this book. The mind that is focused on God is able to be honest, is able to be realistic, and is able to say sometimes life is just rotten. But it's okay. Because there is a God who all the time is in control of all things for His glory. And so it's the perspective from which we see this. The mind that is focused on God is able to say that we are delighted in all that God does, in spite of the fact that what He does is against a backdrop of discouragement, dissatisfaction, and all the effects of sin in our life. God alone gives His people the reason to be satisfied, in spite of the fact that there is evil in this life, according to the first six verses of our text here this evening. And what is that great evil He speaks about? Well, it is knowing that God has given all these blessings, but we don't have any satisfaction. It's a frustrating reality. Hypothetical man that Solomon sets up for us here in verse 2. Here's this man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires. Yet God does not give him power to enjoy them. A stranger enjoys them. Now we know that if there's a blessing, God gives it. And we know that God does give blessings. And we know the blessings come from His hand. Here is a hypothetical person given to us by Solomon in his arguments, who has been blessed by God. He is enjoying wealth. He is enjoying favor. He is enjoying position in life. That all came from God, and he knows that. And so we would say that this person has everything that a heart could possibly desire. I mean, what more does the guy want? Comparatively, this guy is experiencing what everybody in America would like to have. This is the character of America. Wealth, honor, position. You say, well, I don't feel that way. Well, maybe you ought to stop and consider how many people there are who live in third world countries, which is the majority of the world, who would like to have half of what you and I have. They'd be delighted. So we are kind of like this hypothetical person. And God has blessed us, and we do have this abundance of things and abundance of blessings. But here's the question Solomon asks. What if a guy has all that, but God never gave him the power to enjoy it? You know, what kind of a question is that? Especially in light of what we studied just a few weeks ago, chapter 5, verse 18, verse 19. You might want to flip your page back there and look at what Solomon concluded and gave us in that text. Behold what I have seen, verse 18, chapter 5. What I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is a gift from God. The stuff, the wealth, the things, that's a gift from God. But you know what this text says? The power to enjoy it is also a gift from God. The ability to enjoy God's gift is also a gift from God. In fact, that's what the word power, English word translated from the Hebrew, means. It speaks of authority, a mastery over something. So here's the problem. God gives material blessings, but He doesn't give the authority to be able to enjoy that stuff. And so what happens is the stuff becomes the power and the authority over us. And we become the slaves to the stuff. We become the servants to the very blessings that God gives to us. Now, that sad reality just seems to grow and grow and grow. The desire to be satisfied is always stronger, lasts longer than the satisfaction we get from the blessings. You ever experienced that? Jonathan Clements wrote it this way. We may have life and liberty, but the pursuit of happiness, it's not going so well. We constantly hanker after fancier cars, fatter paychecks, and initially such things boost our happiness. But the glow of satisfaction quickly fades and soon we're yearning for something else. Why? Because we only enjoy God's blessing when God gives us the authority to do so. Now, you ought to be asking a question right now in your mind. How does he do that? You know, what is that? What is this power and authority that God gives us so that we can enjoy the very things that he gives us? And the answer is simply this. Through God's grace, God helps us rivet our attention on him. And if you don't have God's grace, it's really hard to focus on him. But it's by God's grace that he draws our attention to himself. And we glorify him in our mind, and we focus on him in our mind, and we want to be consumed with him in our mind, because we are being identified with God, not our stuff. And only by God's grace do we become identified with God, and then we are able to keep his blessings in the right order. God first, God everything. All that God gives is subsidiary, it's secondary. It can never take the place of God, but you know what happens in real life, right? The stuff always takes the place of the one who gives it. And so, we're only able to enjoy what God gives when we are first enjoying the original channel of that blessing. Now, we're going to talk about more of that when we get toward the end of the sermon. Well, Solomon says, you know, here's the problem. We have all these blessings that God has given to us, and yet he hasn't given us the authority or the power to enjoy this stuff, and that's really an evil and futility. Go back to verse 1. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. Look at the last part of verse 2. What is it? This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. Where is this problem taking place? Well, verse 1 says it's under the sun. What is under the sun? Well, life. This is a way of saying, I'm talking about the limitations of life as we know it on this earth, passing life. And there is a great evil in this temporal setting, this passing. Life relegated to the earth, plagued by all of the effects of sin, is indeed evil. That's a good way to describe it. Solomon says the most obvious evil and discouragement there is having stuff. No ability, no opportunity to enjoy it. It's a grievous evil. It's kind of like if you went out and bought a really, 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 really nice boat. I mean, really nice, okay? We're talking about a 34-foot inboard, outboard, you know, cabin cruiser. But now you have to work two jobs in order to afford it. When do you use it? You don't. And you live out the old saying, the two happiest days in a boat owner's life is the day he buys it and the day he sells it. What if you have this blessing and you don't have any opportunity to enjoy it? And Solomon says, well, I tell you what that is. It's Hebel. It's vanity. It's grabbing handfuls of wind. It is the ultimate character of the age in which you're living right now. I mean, all around us, we're constantly bombarded with these pressures to just get more and more and more of this stuff. And it's only 1995. But wait, if you order now, we'll send you two of these things you don't need for 1995. And we're going to throw in a flashlight. How many people, you know, jump for that and say, wow, more stuff? And Solomon said, yeah, you can't even enjoy it. But people you know, do they ever live in denial? Do they ever pretend they're enjoying it? Do they ever pretend that life is great? Life is a blast. Well, yeah, turn on the television and you get that constantly. Everything is so plastic, so make-believe. What do they think when they are alone? Occasionally they'll tell us, and it's an ugly picture. If satisfaction can be found in the things of this life, why do the things of this life have to keep changing? You ever stop and think about that? If there's satisfaction in life, why is new and improved the constant mantra? If it's satisfying, you don't need it to be new and improved. And that's just proof that it's not. It cannot be. Solomon says, that's a gross evil of life. We have all of these things available to us and yet not have available to us the power and the ability to enjoy it. And then he gives us this gruesome but very true illustration of how to deal with this kind of a thing. First, he says, there's just no satisfaction even in the good things. And this is what you have here now in this text is the preacher's comparison. He does this quite a bit. Verse 3, you'll find this. Where he does this comparison, better to not be born than to live for 2,000 years and never get any satisfaction in life. That's basically what he says. Look at verse 3. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his life, his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, he also has no burial, and he'll continue this thought. Again, this is a hypothetical person. It has to be a hypothetical person because if you look down at verse 6, he's continuing the thought, even if he should live 1,000 years twice, that's 2,000. Okay, many people would say, Solomon, that is a horrible idea. If people who are looking forward to eternity with Christ, living outside of this world of sin, living away from this body of sin in a perfect world, in perfect peace with God forever. We don't want to live to be 2,000, right? I mean, nobody would. More than that, this hypothetical man that Solomon sets up has 100 children. Okay, that was a big deal in that culture, to father children. 100 would be quite a blessing. And he has all of life's good things, you'll notice. He's not satisfied with the good things. And this idea starts showing up here and in chapter 7. What is good? The Hebrew word that is used here is tob. You'll find it in verse 3, verse 6, verse 9, verse 12. Come over to chapter 11, or chapter 7, it's used 11 different times. This is a very significant word because it means good in so many different areas of your life. I mean, here's a person who has that which is good. What is that? Well, it's practically good, therefore it's useful, it's economically good. You know, it contributes to the economy, contributes to my financial well-being, or it might be abstract goodness, like something that's desirable, something that is pleasant, something that is beautiful, like a sunset. You would call that good. Can't own it, but it's still good. Or it speaks of quality or expense, something that's very valuable, or moral goodness, or even a technical or philosophical goodness. That is a good idea or a good explanation to whatever problem of life you're talking about. Here is the hypothetical man that Solomon gives to us. And he says, look at him. He's experiencing the good of life to the extreme. What more could a person ask for? But notice, as Solomon goes on in verse 3, he says, but wait. This guy has the good life. He can live 2,000 years, has 100 kids, everything's going great, he has all these blessings, but last part of verse 3, his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. In fact, he won't even be buried by his family. Notice this carefully. Where is the problem? The satisfaction does not reside in his soul. This is a spiritual problem. It's not a physical problem. It's not a material problem. It's not a financial problem. He's not satisfied in his soul. And that is the problem in America. The soul of America is sold out to the god of materialism. And there's absolutely no satisfaction that can be found there. And the worst part is the trickle-down theory that often happens, so that this even begins to affect religious people who ought to know better and who ought to think better. People who ought to know that it is only God, the Creator Himself, who placed eternity in our souls, Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11, who is able to satisfy that which He has placed in our soul. It's a spiritual problem. Only God who created us can possibly fill the void in our soul that is shaped like God. That's eternity in our hearts. And only God is able to satisfy that, and yet your whole world is trying to figure out a way to satisfy that gnawing desire with stuff that's not shaped like God. And that's not characteristic of God. God made us in His image, so that we can have fellowship with Him and He with us. And because of that, He is the only one, He is the only thing that can bring that ultimate satisfaction. Therefore, without God, we have no power, no authority to enjoy and be satisfied with the blessings that God Himself gives us. Even the simple blessings of common grace. Look at the last part of verse 6. Yet we enjoy no good, and do we not all go to one place? I mean, we try, we burn out our lives trying to find something to fill that God-shaped void. There is no satisfaction, and what happens? We all go to the grave. Well, that's encouraging. Wait, is there an answer to this dilemma? I don't know. Last part of verse 3, verse 4, Solomon says, really, non-existence is just better than dissatisfaction. This gets pretty gruesome. I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes in vanity, it goes in darkness, and darkness his name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun nor known anything, yet it finds rest rather than that person who can't find any satisfaction in the material things of life. You know, this is the same thing that Solomon argued back in chapter 4, verse 3, where he says, it would have been better if we'd never been born. Pretty negative. Why? Well, because if a child is born, that child grows up in a life that is full of sin, in a life that is full of vanity, and he gets into this rat race of trying to find satisfaction with that which does not satisfy, and that's futility. He says, look at the stillborn child. He never has to deal with that. It's never an issue. And he has rest rather than the person born. This is such a negative, gruesome illustration. In fact, the psalmist, David, probably used this very same picture as a curse against his enemy. Psalm 58, verse 6. God, break the teeth of their mouths, tear out the fangs of the young lions. O Lord, let them vanish like water that runs away. When he aims his arrows, let them be blunted. Let them be like the snail that dissolves into slime. No, that's very positive, right? Like the stillborn child who never sees the sun. And David says, that's how I curse my enemies. preacher picks it up, Koheleth, Solomon, and says, yeah, but you know what? Better to be like that than be born and never have the opportunity or power to enjoy God's blessing. You're probably thinking, boy, you know, we just need a break from that. Okay, good. Most commentators think verse 7 is a break. In fact, there are a lot of them who just say, you know, the whole tenor, the whole shape of this book changes at verse 7, chapter 6. And that is true. It really does. We'll see that a little bit next week or a couple weeks from now. Be that as it may, you're going to notice in the final verses of this chapter, verse 7 through verse 12, it's still the same problem, seeking satisfaction in life and not being able to find it. And so he goes to the vanity of the mouth, continuing with his argument about dissatisfaction. He says, the problem is, verse 7, 8, 9, 10, we eat, we're not even satisfied. And right here he presents three difficult questions, three things that are just kind of hard for us to deal with. One, in light of dissatisfaction, what difference does it make whether we're wise or a fool? You know, we're not going to get any satisfaction about the things in life anyway. Verse 7, all the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite's not satisfied. What advantage has the wise man over the fool? That mention of the mouth, you know what he's talking about there, right? It's just a natural appetite. Is there anybody here who does not like to eat? I knew there was going to be somebody raise their hand. Sometimes we all feel that way, don't we? It's like, you know, I'd rather not. I got a lot to do. I'm busy. I really don't want to eat. But most of us, most of the time, like to eat something, right? It's an appetite. Hits you about three times a day. It's noon. Time to eat lunch. Why? It's noon. Are you hungry? Well, no, it's noon. We have to. That's our habitual appetite. We're used to feeding that, right? And the preacher says, yeah, that's life. We have these cravings. We have these natural desires. We have these appetites. And we go to work in order to feed them. And we feed the desire. And it's satisfied for a short time. And then it's back. And what he's saying is this, you know, that's life. All your desires are like that. You feed them and they come back. They're satisfied for a little while, but then it doesn't matter what kind of stuff from your world you feed. It keeps coming back. And he says, ultimately, it really doesn't matter whether we're wise or foolish. The same law applies to all of us. Physical appetites are just very temporarily satisfied. And so exercising wisdom, that doesn't make you undo the natural desires of the flesh and the appetites. Verse 8. Last part of the verse, what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? So what? I mean, you know how to conduct yourself. You know how to be wise. What advantage is that? Now this is actually kind of a proverb from the ancients. It's kind of like this. If you conduct yourself in wisdom, you will have health because you will have everything provided for you that you need for a healthy life. All right? It's a general rule in the Proverbs. We see that over and over and over. Go to, you sluggard, consider the ant, you know? You just have all these statements to say, if you conduct yourself wisely, it's going to lead to health. Kind of like Benjamin Franklin's wisdom saying, right? Early to bed, early to rise, makes a man what? Healthy, wealthy, wise. So, what time do you go to bed? You know, there's some people who actually believe that. I do. I believe early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy. But not always even that, okay? Sometimes that doesn't even work, and that's the nature of wisdom literature. You can't say wisdom literature is a law, but rather wisdom literature says generally this is the way these kinds of things work out. And so Solomon argued, here's this guy. He's wise. He exercises wisdom. He conducts himself appropriately. He might be poor, might be rich. Doesn't matter. He can't satisfy himself. None of the natural appetites are satisfied. It doesn't matter whether you're wise or fool. So you come to this frustrating conclusion. An insatiable appetite results in futility and dissatisfaction. Verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and striving after the wind. Okay, he's been taught. This gets a little confusing, doesn't it? Okay, it's almost philosophical, but not quite. He's been talking about our inability to satisfy our natural desires. Doesn't matter whether we're wise or foolish. The same people have same problems. You try to satisfy the appetite and it comes back. That's frustrating, he says. Better is the sight of the eyes. Another one of his better than things. You say, this doesn't make sense to me. Yes, it does. A bird in the hand is better than two in a bush. Have you ever heard that? That's what Solomon said right here. Better what you can see than what you can hope for or that you wish things would be. Basically saying this, the grass is really not greener on the other side of the fence. Better what is before your eyes than what you're hoping for. So instead of always wanting something new, something different, something better, someone else, here's the argument. Rest in God's will. Because ultimately, it is God who determines the end. Verse 10. Whatever has come to be has already been named. It is known, and it is known what man is. Whatever has come, it was already named before it came. What is that talking about? God created all things. God named all things. Go all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. And he called what? Over and over, you just see this. Okay? And he called the darkness night. He named it. He called the light day. And we've been using those words ever since then. Right? And tomorrow you will get up and the day will come and you'll say it is a new day. And God says, well, yeah, I created that way back in Genesis chapter 1 verse 1. Because I'm in control of everything. And I maintain everything. And I sustain everything. Because God is the authority to do this in our life. And he demonstrated that for us. For example, when he created all things, he created all the animals, but what did he do? You remember he took all the animals and sent them to Adam. Why? Well, notice Genesis chapter 2 verse 19. Out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them, and whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. Do you see what this is saying? Whoever names the thing has the authority over the thing. Right? So Christopher Columbus comes over here, names this place, I guess. What did he name it? And we just always say whoever named it, they had the authority. God named everything. Therefore, verse 10, he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. Stop arguing with God. Stop saying, God, this will bring me satisfaction. This will bring me satisfaction. This will bring me satisfaction. No, rest in God. He's in control of all things. He has named everything. We propose theories, we argue, we come up with all kinds of arguments and plans and all these debating and all these philosophies saying, no, this is how we are going to find satisfaction in life. And Solomon says, no, it doesn't work that way. You know, what we speak really has no vital answer, 11 and 12. Three unanswered questions. What is the advantage of multiplied words? Verse 11. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage of man or to man? What does all of the conclusions and all of the arguments and all of the evidence, what advantage does it bring us? How many words are we talking about here? Here's an interesting illustration. The size of the internet in 2012 was calculated to be 2,800 zettabytes. Are you impressed? Well, folks, you have to understand that's 2.8 exabytes. Now I know you're impressed. All right, let me put it in terms you might be familiar with. You ever hear of a terabyte? Some of you might actually have a computer with a terabyte hard drive on it. Okay, that's a lot. In 2012, the size of the internet was equivalent to 2.8 billion terabytes. Now, that's a phenomenal size. To store this amount of data, you'd need 700 million 4-terabyte hard drives. Well, in 2013, the amount of information on the internet was 3.7 zettabytes. In 2016, the amount of data passing through the internet grew to about 26,500 gigabytes per second. And they estimate that by 2020, the growth of traffic on the internet is going to grow by 20%, enlarged to 40 zettabytes. That means that we're going to have about 50 billion different devices attached to the internet in 2020. How much information is that? That's so much information that we really can't even illustrate it by the number of books that it would take. Just be satisfied to say, that's a lot of information. That's a lot of talking. That's a lot of words. And Solomon says, how much satisfaction do you get from that? None. All this talking, still dissatisfied. Question number two. What is good for man, really? Verse 12. For who knows what is good for man while he lives, the few days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow. You know, almost everybody you talk to has an opinion about what is good. Well, you'd think if something is good, it would satisfy, it would bring enjoyment, it would make us happy, right? You say, well, that was good. Yeah, but it's not good for very long. That's the problem. The goodness kind of wears off. And that's why Americans are obsessed with happy endings. You just have to have a happy ending, right? And they lived happily ever after. I'm sure an American must have invented that saying. So, yeah, even in the face of really, really serious, really negative circumstances, there are people who just say in their mind, yeah, I'd rather be a Pollyanna. Now, I'm not going to admit the truth. Say, what's a Pollyanna? Well, it's an excessively cheerful, optimistic person. They just pretend that everything's coming up roses all the time. British author Carl Truman wrote this in his book, Fools Rush In Where Monkeys Fear to Tread. It's a great read. He says, I remember my jaw hitting the floor some years ago when I watched a Disney version of Notre Dame de Paris where the hunchback does not die but lives happily ever after. The point of the story of Quasimodo is that the guy with a lump dies in the end, and it's terribly sad. My wife is meant to cry. I am meant to feel angry at the raw deal Quasimodo has been dealt in the poker game of life. What is good? If we have to become unrealistic and live in denial to claim that something is good so that it brings us satisfaction, you know what we're going to discover? It's not going to satisfy us anyway. In fact, when Jesus tells us what is really good, there's something in our soul that just says, no, that can't be so. Think of the Beatitudes, for example. Jesus says, this is good. Matthew 5, verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit. No. Jesus, blessed are the happy. In fact, the word blessed means happy. Happy are those people who are happy. Jesus says, no, happy are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Happy are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Happy are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Happy are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they shall be satisfied. That's good. He goes on, verse 10. Happy are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Happy are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Apparently, God does not intend for us, does not desire for us to find happiness in the circumstances of life in this world. Yeah, if that's never been clearer, it's in the Beatitudes. Where does he expect us to find it? Verse 12, Matthew 5. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. See, maybe we're not satisfied because we're not really willing to admit what is good for us. Third question, what comes next? Who can tell, verse 12, who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? And the answer is nobody really knows. God does. So what should we do? Well, maybe we should rest in God's wisdom, in God's will, in God's plan for our lives. Now, let me close with the important answers to the questions. I just gave you three questions that Solomon posed to us, right? What is the advantage of multiplied words? Well, what's the answer to that? God created us for His glory. That's the answer. We have all these words and all this information, and it just builds up, and we have boatloads of it. We don't know what to do with it. We're in information overload all the time. Just stop. Why am I here? For God's glory. Now, what is all this stuff in the world? It's for God's glory. Psalm 96, verse 8, ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. Bring an offering, come into His courts. Exodus 15, 11, who is like You, O Lord God, Lord among the gods? Who is like You, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? Nobody's like God. And no God is like God. And He created us that His glory would be increased, would be magnified by us. That second question, what is really good? Well, what is good is the fact that God sustains us for His own glory. God said, Psalm 75, verse 3, when the earth totters and all its inhabitants, it is I who keep steady its pillars. You believe that? When your life is shaking and your pillars feel like they're going to fall over and you don't have the answer, do you really think it is God who sustains that? And He said, I hold it steady. That's the work of Jesus. One of my favorite passages, Colossians chapter 1, verse 13 through 17. Christ has delivered us from the domain of darkness, transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He, Christ, the beloved Son, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by Him all things were created in heaven, on earth, visible, invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through Him, for Him. And He is before all things, and in Him right now everything is holding together. That's good. That is what's good for us. Just focus on Christ. Third, what comes next? The answer to that's always easy. God. You know, life is about God. So whatever you do in word or deed, do all to the glory of God, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. Whether you eat, drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Trust in Him with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him. He will show you what comes next. It's His plan. It's His purpose for His glory. So, rather than us being unrealistic and adopting this attitude of life like, if it's negative, if it's pessimistic, I don't want to hear it. Let's be realistic. The child of God says, tell me the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I want it all. Why? Well, because the truth is, God is truth. The truth is, the God of truth is in control. The truth is, the God of truth who's in control of all things invites us to rest in Him by faith. So that I honestly can look at life and say, is it painful? Yep. Sometimes lose?
Yep.
Sometimes things don't turn out the way I want it to turn out?
Yep.
Sometimes I just feel very discouraged?
Yep.
And I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You see, that's when we're bringing glory to God. When we just realize this is God's world. And this is God's plan. And He's given us what we need in order to accomplish His will for His glory. So this really is a pretty positive book sometimes, right? When we fill in the blanks.